I'm a helpful Southern California Honda person, and recently we've been doing random acts of helpfulness, like repairing a family's home after a water leak, helping pay for a wedding, and surprising a deserving child with a birthday party at the LA Zoo. And during the Honda Dream Garage Spring event, we can help you too with a great deal on an award-winning Honda, like the all-new and completely redesigned Accord, the 2018 North American Car of the Year. Click the dealer locator link to find a dealer near you, and go to SoCalHondaDealers.com to suggest a random act of helpfulness for someone you know.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon.
Hi, this is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in therapy and research. Tonight's show is about women and sexual power, why some women feel like passive participants in their sex lives, and why and how other women are able to feel comfortable in their sexual skin. Talking with me tonight is a researcher whose work I've included in my advice columns. She's officially Penn State Associate Professor of Sociology, Dr. Beth Montemurro, but I think of her as anthropologist, Dr. Beth Montemurro, because she really does some of the most interesting observational anthropology research out there, and not of natives in some other society, but of natives in our own. Her last book was about bachelorettes going to strip clubs based on her research. And she studied why they go and how their experience differs from the typical male one. And it is very different why they go and how their experience differs. Her book we'll be discussing tonight is Deserving Desire, Women's Stories of Sexual Evolution. Stick with us for some fascinating findings about women and sex. Hello, Beth.
Hello.
So you've written a very interesting book, essentially by interviewing a lot of women about their sexuality, and women from of all ages, and about their sexual agency, the level of control they have over who they are and how they act sexually. You've pieced together the story of women's sexual evolution. But before we talk about that, I want to start with where I first encountered your research, back when you were spending a lot of time in strip clubs, the kind where men in leopard print G-strings shake it for the ladies. So you're looking at why women go to strip clubs, as I said before, which in general tends to not be for the same reason men go. So, Beth, why do women go to strip clubs?
So what I found in doing that research was that the women that I interviewed, the women that I observed, were going to strip clubs more for an experience of bonding with their friends, that the experience was not about being turned on necessarily, but more about having a fun night out, and so that they use the strippers really as entertainment and as a vehicle to bonding with one another.
So, and people don't really believe that. I've encountered that people, you know, even when I wrote about your research, which you had done, you'd actually gone, you found out the real deal. People don't want to believe that. Why is that?
I think that people like to believe what they see in fictional media, and I guess even in reality television, that women are hypersexual and that there's really not that much difference between men and women can be turned on in the same way that men can be turned on. But when I talk to women about the experience and when I observe them in these clubs, it was really something very different. Women were embarrassed sometimes by very close contact with strippers, and so that they would look at their friends while they were having a dance from a stripper and laugh with their friends, high-five each other, in a way of this is an experience that we're sharing rather than this is an experience that is about me being really turned on by this stripper.
So in other words, most women or many women are not visually turned on the way men are. You know, a guy looks at a woman shaking in a strip club and he's turned on. He's not thinking, oh, this is so nice how my buddies and I were all getting together for this, you know, sort of prank-like experience of a bachelor party.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't interview men, so I can't say so much about their experience, but certainly from what I understand about it, what I've read about it in the academic literature, not just in popular culture, that it is just a different experience. And most of the research corroborates this fact that women are less visually stimulated than men.
Yeah, I certainly know that from EBSYCH. That's a big priority for men is the visuals, whereas women are looking for providers. And if you're, you know, really kind of built like a soccer ball, but you have a jet, it adds sort of, I think, a couple feet to your height and appeal.
Sure.
So what struck you at the time was the brief period of time that expressions of sexuality were okay for women and how quickly some women you interviewed disconnected from, you know, the single woman role they played at the bachelor party. And just to be clear, you know, some women, you know, they got lap dances or whatever, but that was like, it was like a Cinderella period.
Yeah. And so right. So finishing the first book is what inspired me to write the second book, and that I was trying to get pictures to put in my book, and several of the women said, no, they're too embarrassing. And they really were not incriminating pictures. These were pictures where women were, you know, holding a penis-shaped water bottle or just standing around with friends drinking shots or, you know, something like that. They were really non-incriminating pictures. But the women that I asked said, you know, I'm married now, I'm a mother, and I just don't feel comfortable with those pictures being out there. And I thought that that was really interesting, that it was this time at the bachelorette party where you could show your sexuality, where you could play with sexuality pretty much almost as much as you wanted to. And then once you got married, that was it, that sexuality became once again this private expression, and that it just was as if it didn't exist publicly. And so So that there was this change, and that was really interesting to me. So I wanted to understand more about it and why it, you know, did women really feel that way, or was this just something that I was observing with the particular women who I had interviewed for the first book?
Well, what struck me about the book we're discussing tonight, Deserving Desire, Women's Stories of Sexual Evolution, I'm talking with Dr. Beth Montemuro, the author, it's how many women are so different that some women are able to be much more comfortable than others. And you, but I guess first let's just talk about you, the research that you write about in this book. You looked at a very broad spectrum of women and, you know, to look at their sexuality, which usually isn't done. People study teens or older women. And so that makes this especially interesting because you're able to compare and contrast sexuality of women throughout their lives, even though they're different women at different times.
Right. Yeah, thank you. I think that my goal was to understand different points in life, and because, as you mentioned, most of the research that looks at how women feel about their sexuality focuses on adolescent sexual development, teen sexual development, and nothing really covered what happened after that until women get to menopause. So it was like you have this whole long period of midlife, the time when most people are most sexually active, and there was very little information out there about how women feel about it. So there's research about sexual behavior that talks about how women's sexual behavior, women's frequency of intercourse decreases after having a baby and as you get older, things that anybody would predict. There was just very little about how women felt about that transition. So I wanted to look at this with this diverse group of women to understand how women felt at different ages, and also women of different generations. So to look at how what was going on in history, what was going on in society impacted the way that women felt about their sexuality.
Now, what really excites me about this book is the way you talk about women who have sexual power and women who don't and how that changes. And you use a research term or a researcher term called sexual subjectivity, but that's a little off-putting sounding. But define that for the audience, because actually that's something I think people will really be interested in, the meaning of this.
So sexual subjectivity is the idea that of having confidence in sexual decision-making, of feeling in touch with somebody, one's sexual desire. It's about being a active agent or just an active person in sexual situations. So a lot of the literature and the studies of teenage sexuality, teenage girls' early experiences talks about girls feeling like objects, that they're people who are acted on rather than acting, so that they follow boys' leads, they participate in, they fool around with boys because they believe that boys want them to, not that they necessarily want to. And it doesn't mean that girls don't feel desire. Teenage girls don't feel desire. Absolutely do. They do. But that because girls get such mixed messages about it, it's hard to feel confident in sexual decisions. It's hard to feel confident about your desire when you're told that you should feel it, you're told that you shouldn't feel it. So sexual subjectivity is just about getting confident in that, in those feelings of desire and in the decisions that somebody makes going forward. It could be not being interested in sex. Somebody can be sexually subjective or have agency and say, you know, I really don't want to have sex in this situation. But it's about feeling in control of your sexuality.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you can be confident about not being interested, because that's something I hear from time to time about asexuals. And this is sort of a population nobody thinks about, the people who are happy not having sex. In fact, I know a researcher who is asexual, and I think, oh, my God, if I had spent my 20s asexual, I mean, I would have a Nobel Prize or I'd be on top of Everest now. Think of that, those lost years. It's really crazy. And that is an advantage, but there are other disadvantages to that because they perhaps have trouble having a relationship because most people are not asexual.
Sure. Yeah, right. Wherever somebody falls on the spectrum of being very sexual or not being that sexual or being asexual, as you said, that it's just about feeling right about it, feeling that is, that you're okay with that and that you're okay standing up for that.
And when you talk about adolescent girls, you say, and I'm not surprised to hear this, that they're sexual assertion, that their confident treatment or look at their sexuality or I guess the outward expression of that is often treated as aggressive or deviant.
Yeah, so girls, you know, it's tough on girls, and it was tough for the older women I interviewed and tough for the younger women that I interviewed, and that for women who are in their teens and 20s now, in this generation, there's just this very confusing, schizophrenic message of that you should be both hypersexual and not sexual, and so, you know, it becomes a very difficult line to walk.
Yeah, this was very interesting to me that you said, you know, there were taboos in previous generations, you know, that women they had a sexist taboo or bad, and that women, that was their stance. And then women born after 1972 were more likely to have a sexist confusing stance. Now, how does sexist confusing affect your sexual development and experience?
Yeah, so what I found is that these women, all the women I interviewed, had some type of an early perspective or stance that they developed on sex, and it was based on the messages that they got from their family, from media, from peers, and so that these younger women, these younger women basically found that sex to be confusing because they were told that they should be sexual, they should show their sexuality, but they also lived in a reality where doing so meant that they could be stigmatized or shamed or embarrassed or humiliated for being aware of that desire. So when you start out with that as your perspective on sex, it becomes very difficult to move into early sexual experiences or even later sexual experiences, feeling really confident or feeling like you have sexual subjectivity, because you're still wrestling with that first message where you were told that sex was both important and not important, sex was both good and bad, and that it was your job to figure that out, to walk that line, which is really very difficult, if not impossible, to be both sexual and not sexual at the same time.
Well, a less sort of fractured view, I saw that when you compared Dutch and American parents, per research, I think it's by Amy Chalet, and tell us a little bit about that and the difference in outcome. How the kids' parents treat sexuality in general, of course, and then the difference in outcome.
Yeah, so Amy Chalet's work is fascinating. She wrote this great book where she compared Dutch teens' experiences with their parents and American teens' experience with their parents, and that she was looking at the differences in that in Dutch culture, the idea of boyfriends or girlfriends sleeping over was normalized, so that a teenager, it would be normal for them to have their boyfriend or girlfriend sleep over. And for American teens, that is pretty much unheard of. So that just that alone suggests this normalization of sexual desire and of sexual activity among teens. It's an acceptance of the reality that it happens, and that the parents, the Dutch parents, felt that if they knew about it, then their child would be more comfortable talking to them about it. They would be more comfortable if they had questions that they wanted to ask. And so it's kind of a better stance. And that what she found in this research was that girls had more agency. Girls were more confident. It was not like girls and boys were identical, but girls certainly were much more confident. And then with American parents, it was the opposite. So American parents dramatized girls' sexuality, and so girls wound up hiding it from their parents because they knew that they would get in trouble if they talked about their sexual desire or asked questions.
Yeah, it seems that parents take a very unrealistic view. I remember my own parents, my mother saying, it's best not to have premarital sex. I think that she knew that was a lost cause. That didn't work out too well. I'm not married. I'm 50. So, and I haven't been a nun. But that is, I contrast that with how my parents dealt with drinking, where I grew up, my family's Jewish, and so they would have this horrible, horrible Manischewitz screw top wine every Friday. Now, perhaps that kept me from drinking. If we had nice wine, maybe I'd be a drunk. But I think that because there was always alcohol, my dad would say, you want some schnapps or some kind of horrible stuff, you know, that I didn't have any kind of fantasies about, oh, my God, someday I'll drink. It was just like, oh, yeah, whatever. And, in fact, when I got drunk, it's like the Dutch kids, my parents, we went to my cousin Patty's wedding when I was 15, and I thought, I want to see what it's like to get drunk, and I'm with my parents, and so I'll be safe. And so I drank vodka and tab, and then I threw up on the way home. My dad laughed at me. And, you know, your dad laughing at you instead of forbidding it. You know, it was just,
right.
I think I barely took a drink in college because of that, because it's sort of like, oh, God, I remember throwing up, you know, and if it had been forbidden, like the Dutch kids, I think that, you know, maybe it would have been, you know, something that was more, that I did in a less healthy way.
Yeah. And, you know, and what I found was consistent with what she found. I mean, I only had a couple people that I interviewed who were of that generation, who were born outside of the United States and raised outside of the United States, who had more progressive parents, but they were more comfortable. They were more comfortable with their sexuality earlier and more confident.
Yeah, I see that with Swiss, with Italian and French friends. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Therapy and Research. My guest tonight is Dr. Beth Montemurro. We're discussing her book, Deserving Desire, Women's Stories of Sexual Evolution. So, oral sex. I've been waiting to get to that one. This is something that I think a lot of people wonder about, how or at least think about how younger women will often perform oral sex and not receive it. And actually, you give an example not just of a teen girl, but of a 25-year-old graduate student talking about her early experiences among her peer girlfriends. Oh, so maybe it's early. Yeah, it is early experiences, but she's 25, and so maybe that's still the case. So tell us a little bit about women receiving performing oral sex and not receiving it.
Yeah, so I had only a couple people who talked about that, but it is certainly those that did said that it was just kind of normal in their group to that boys would expect it, and they never did. And there's been a big study that came out, I think it was 2012, that corroborated this with a large scale population of college students, and found that. Gosh, I wish I remembered the percentages of it, but that it was probably something like 6-1, and only in relationships. Like in hookups, there was no expectation on the part of boys or men or women that men would perform oral sex on women, but that women frequently did and frequently expected to perform it for men. And this study actually just not only looking at oral sex, but just to the idea of women's orgasm, and found that in hookups, there was very little expectation on the part of men for women to have an orgasm. But there was always an expectation that they would have an orgasm, so that there was no sexual encounter for men from their perception if they didn't climax, but it was just fine with them. And often fine with women, or at least expected for them not to.
Now, any speculation as to why that is, both on the oral sex that women are just performing it, not getting it, and on the expectation that, okay, we're going to have sex, I'm getting an orgasm, I'm having an orgasm, I'm a guy, and, you know, well, you know, you just, you know, come along for the ride.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is because we define sex so much by ejaculation, and that we expect men to have more of a sex drive than women. We understand men's orgasm, men's climax, men's genitals better than we understand women's. And so I think that it just, you know, that it all kind of goes together, that I think that men often don't know, especially in hookup situations where they're not in a relationship with somebody, how to satisfy a woman, and so they don't. They don't try. They don't expect to. And then I guess as far as the oral sex, why that happens less, I think that that's similar. I think that there is that same expectation that men's erection is there, and so that it is it's easier to see, there's more of an expectation and a cultural understanding of how to deal with it. And I don't think that that's true for women. And also just thinking about like sex education and the fact that where you have sex education that teaches you anything more than abstinence, that there's no, you know, women's orgasm is not necessary for reproduction, and most sex education focuses on reproduction. And so that there's no basis, no motivation for teaching about it. And so people know a lot less about it.
Yeah, there are a few things you brought up. One of the things was this idea of sex ed, that they don't talk about desire. You write about this in your book, here's the uterus, you know, but nobody talks about desire. And that seems to be something that's an important part of this, but I guess they're just too nervous to talk about that.
Yeah, and it's so political, you know, that the fact that so many places still focus on abstinence-only education, which has found to not be an effective way of teaching about sex. Yeah, I think people are afraid, and I think that, you know, that's something that I really hope will change, that there will be some recognition that girls and boys feel desire, and so that that's an important part of sexuality that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, it seems like a real
important too, but
yeah, it seems like a real missing piece, because in order to deal with desire, you have to have some kind of idea of it. And, you know, as you're talking about with sex, you know, that people don't have any idea that, look, lots of people feel this way. If you're not reading a bunch of literature, you're not reading that stuff about, you know, Madame Bovary and all these books where people's desire, you know, became very problematic. And so you see, you know, it's just, and to have it be a mystery, not even have the Madame Bovary version, you know, that seems sort of bad and damaging even. Getting back to what you said, yeah, it's really true. Men's genital, it's just very visual, you know, and you talk about how nobody talks about the clitoris. It's barely mentioned.
Right.
Really, it is. It's like the outsider of sex, you know, and how does that affect, you know, how women talk about their bodies and feel about their bodies and feel about sex?
So, there was a great study done by sociology friend of mine, Dennis Wasko, and Philip Benigni and Desiree Weissen, and that they looked at just kind of this, how women discover their clitoris, and how that a lot of them don't really, because you're never taught, don't really understand its function and have to figure it out on their own. And just that alone, like that this is the primary source of sexual pleasure for women, the fact that it is a body part that is rarely named, rarely talked about, that it's not part of your sex education, is really significant because it's really hard to be confident, to be a subject, to have sexual subjectivity or agency if you're not really sure on how your body works and how you can achieve sexual pleasure or sexual satisfaction.
How do women discover the clitoris?
What this study found by Dennis Waskell and his colleagues was that they discovered it sometimes by accident, feeling desire and masturbating either as children kind of figuring their bodies out or as teenagers or young women figuring out about their desire, or that their partners helped them discover it, that just having somebody else, and it was often that, having somebody else touch it for them first allow them to say, wow, this feels good, and led them to further investigation.
See, that's the problem, because you could see women following that guy around like the Pied Piper, when it could happen with any guy or a bunch of guys. And so that's sort of let's leave women in the dark about this. That can be damaging. Get a woman with the wrong guy for a while just out of, thinking that this is some kind of special thing that he only can give her.
Yeah, and that was something that really carried through in my research, was that a number of women their path to sexual subjectivity, to feeling confident, to feeling like they had agency or were in control of their sexuality, began with somebody else, began with a man encouraging them or teaching them something about their body or having that experience, rather than being driven by their own desire or their own active pursuit of trying to explore their sexuality, that it was something that was externally driven rather than internally driven.
And I just wanted to go back to something you mentioned about research on women not having orgasm through hookups. And I've read a bunch of research on this, and you mentioned something too, that women often need to have an emotional connection to be relaxed enough to have an orgasm. And so, and I've talked about this in my column that, hookups, they're not necessarily so great for everyone. If you just want to feel close to somebody and roll around naked and everything, but that a lot of women should notice that they never have an orgasm from hookups and see if that's something that works for them. And I say that as somebody who's not against it and who doesn't agree with these people who say, oh my God, girls are hooking up, oh, this is the end of the world. No, it's something you're going to do until they're ready for a relationship, and then they'll be in a relationship. So about that emotional connection and hookups, what do you think?
I think that that's a good point. If that's how women feel, if that's what women need in order to experience pleasure, to feel satisfied, then sure, the hookup is not going to bring them that. And other research on hookups has found that women do it more as a vehicle to a relationship rather than that they're motivated for the sexual pleasure. Some of the more recent research certainly finds that women that it's pleasurable and that women like it and don't regret it, but that it doesn't mean that they're climaxing. It doesn't mean that they're as satisfied with that sex as the sex that they have in relationships.
Yeah, and you say, I recall reading somewhere in the book that the percentages are very low as far as the success of hookups leading to relationships.
Yes. Yeah. So research by Kathleen Bogle and Elizabeth Armstrong has found that out, that it's because men and women have different expectations going in, and that the men more often don't expect it to lead to a relationship, and they are more often driving that. It doesn't usually happen.
And maybe you agree with me, maybe you don't, but I think that this has something to do with how women evolved to be the choosier sex and men co-evolved to expect that. And so that when women, as much as I know it sounds like your grandmother standing over you with a wooden spoon as I say this, but if it is too easy to get a woman, if there is no, I have to chase her and this is difficult, that maybe men devalue women, maybe not even meaning to, it's just how we evolved to think.
Yeah, Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's a lot of a lot in our culture that supports that. But I think it's sad. You know, I think it's sad because I think that women can want similar things, and that, you know, it's unfortunate. I think that that's what happens, because there's more consequences for women. You know, it's one thing if it's the woman wants a relationship and the man doesn't, and then they don't have a relationship. But when the woman then is also shamed or stigmatized, or, you know, called a slut, called a whore for hooking up, and the man is not, you know, it's just, it has more consequences for women.
So let's talk a little bit about experiences that encourage young women's sexual agency. You use the research term sexual subjectivity, but it really means, you know, women being these willing and eager participants in their sex lives, or at least confidently deciding they're not going to have one. And yes. You talk about this girl, Autumn, who developed some strategies to control and set limits. And you say that her experience was atypical among your American interviewees.
Yeah, so Autumn was somebody who was raised in Southern California and in a very liberal family, liberal household, and so that she was somebody whose parents talked to her about sex, who were very open with their own sex lives, to the point where it was uncomfortable for her talking about their sex lives with each other. And so so her experience, yes, was atypical, and that she, because of growing up in this environment, it was kind of like, I guess, similar to the Dutch teenagers or your experience with drinking, that she was so exposed to sex that she decided that she was not going to just have it casually, that she wanted to be sure about when she was going to have it. She wanted to feel like she was making her own decisions, and so that she expected there to be sexual pressures, and so she came up with a little script that she would say to boys when they pursued her, where she basically said that she told them that she wasn't going to have sex until she felt like she was ready, and that she was she was waiting for love, she was waiting for a serious relationship, and just having that speech prepared made her feel more confident, made her feel like she knew what to do, she had a plan, so it wasn't like this, you know, uncomfortable or anxiety-producing situation. She was prepared, and she didn't have sex until she felt ready, and, you know, I think that really benefited her.
That's kind of funny. It is like my parents in drinking. Her parents sort of bored her out of the idea of having sex. You see all these kids with, oh, it's a forbidden fruit, and they have to sneak around in the back of cars and everything. And,
right.
And I saw something like this, too. There's a family that kind of adopted me in New York. They're like my New York family. And the parents
mm-hmm.
really talk about everything, like poop and sex with their kids.
Mm-hmm.
And these
mm-hmm.
kids actually, I saw them having an experience and an attitude towards sex. Like you described, they weren't sex mad. I mean, they had it, and they had girlfriends and stuff eventually, but they didn't rush the way I saw kids rushing who had parents who took the forbidden sex is evil, sex is bad approach when I was growing up. And I was born in 64.
Yeah, yeah. And there were, you know, a handful of women like this that I interviewed, maybe a little bit more than a handful, that had parents who were open with them, who had parents who talked to them about it, and they went into their early sexual experiences sure of what they wanted to do, and that they, whether they wanted to or didn't want to, or how they prepared or how they didn't prepare, or how they talked about it with their partner, their boyfriend, to get a sense of how they both felt about it and when they both felt that they were ready. It was really interesting to see how much of a difference that made for these women going forward and feeling better about their sexual relationships as they got older.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting to see the difference. We'll next talk about women feeling validated by their appeal to men and the positive and negative of that. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Therapy and Research. My guest tonight is Dr. Beth Montemurro, and her book we're discussing is Deserving Desire, Women's Stories of Sexual Evolution. Okay, so women feeling validated by their appeal to men. That's something you hear, you know, sort of mocked by feminists. But there are positives and negatives to that, and tell us what they are.
So the positives are that it brings women closer to feeling sexual, feeling in control of their sexuality, feeling sexual agency, feeling empowered in sexual situations. It helps them to understand their bodies better. It helps them to feel more physically satisfied. It makes relationships stronger often because they feel a greater sense of connection because they realize that their partner really not only is physically attracted to them, but wants them to feel sexual. And that's a really big deal because if girls are getting these girls and as girls and young women, people are getting the message that being sexual is bad or having too much sexual desire is bad, that to have somebody say it's not bad and they think it's great and that they want them to and they want to encourage it really makes a difference because then they can finally feel like, okay, great, you know, I can explore my sexuality, I can figure out my body, and that I feel like somebody is telling me that it's a good thing to do. So that's the positive side of it. As far as the negatives,
yes.
The negatives are that it still becomes externally driven, that it's still about somebody else kind of taking them there and rather than them figuring it out on their own.
But I don't think if they're, I guess, okay, they're not figuring it out on their own, but if they're satisfied, it doesn't seem a terrible thing. And maybe, and feel free to disagree with me, but
yeah.
And maybe I'm oversimplifying this, but you know, I'm looking at what you said and trying to pull some advice out of this. So I'm thinking, okay, so men, to keep their partners sexual, because that's an important part of a relationship survival, that
yeah.
Maybe they need to tell her she's beautiful and show her that she's desired to express that, grab her and say, you're so beautiful today or sexy or something. So the woman doesn't feel like she's not desired. Is that correct or am I oversimplifying?
I think that that's part of it, but I think that it's much more specific to sex than that. It's about, I like that you are, that you want to have sex. I like that you're interested in sex. I like that you want to do something different sexually. It's not just about that you're attractive, but it's about that you're sexual and that that's a good thing. And so I think that partners who make women feel, help women feel confident, who validate their desire, really help women be more sexual and be sexually freer.
But this is something very interesting that you bring up, that sexuality, it isn't something that's just expressed with others, because that's how I always think of it. But you
yeah.
take another look, this idea that, okay, well, you know, this is externally driven. And so talk about that and our sexual self-image and how it gets formed.
Yeah, so I think that so that was one of the things that I was interested in when I started doing the research for this book, was about is sexuality something that women only feel directed to somebody else, or do women feel a sense of their sexuality when they're not in a relationship? Do they still feel that burning desire for, you know, for sex? Do they masturbate? Do they seek out sexual satisfaction if they're not in a relationship? So that I found that for the most part, more of the single women that I interviewed, more of the women who were unpartnered at the time I interviewed them, really didn't have a strong burning desire, that most of it was directed at somebody in a relationship. But it's not only that. And so that if you look at how a woman's sexual self-image, how it's developed, part of it, it's the same influences, right? So looking at family, looking at peers, looking at media, and what are those messages saying about how women should feel? And so that older women, mothers, married women who are culturally desexualized or not seen as sexual in culture and popular culture and media feel less sexual, or that the sexuality is more private because there's not really a model for a public expression of sexuality for women in those categories. So all of those sources kind of influence women's sexual self-image.
And something interesting, too, that you bring up that I found fascinating is that, you know, the media present images of girls and women, these hypersexual images, and glorify women who present their bodies, highlighting the sex appeal. But that you said women know that such presentations are not reality. And that was fascinating to me because, I mean, this is all the people trying to stop, you know, oh, this is too sexy and let's stop the photoshopping. I mean, they treat women basically like they're idiots. And that I mean, don't we all know that magazines are retouched and that nobody looks like that? They don't have perfect skin like that or perfect anything. Or they have plastic surgery.
Right. Yeah. I think that, you know, so many women talked about that, especially the older women when I was talking with them about the idea of their desirability and how they felt about kind of no longer fitting or being able to attain what naturally attain that culturally desirable look or what's desirable in popular culture. And that they talked about that, how the older you get, the less you try, not only because you're older and you know that you're older, but because the more aware you are about how fake it all is and how it really never was attainable because it's not reality.
And now, in a sense, we seem to be talking about women as if they're handicapped in sexual development, but that sounds like they're sort of knowing. And I wonder, too, if we were studying men, you know, would you be talking in similar ways, like these poor guys, they don't know what they're doing? So maybe it's not just women. Maybe it's a human thing and a thing of being a culture where we talk about, we sort of deify abstinence and don't talk about desire and all the rest.
Yeah, I don't think it would be the same for men. I really don't, and I won't know until I finish my next study, which is interviewing men. But that I think because culture, women's and men's sexuality so differently, and because we're really just on the cusp of hypersexualizing men and men's bodies in media, the way that we have with women's bodies, that I think that it's a very different story that we tell about women's sexuality and men's sexuality. I think the story about men's sexuality is very narrow and very limiting and constraining to men in their sexual expression, but not in the same way because it's still about being sexual, whereas the story for women is about not being sexual. And yeah, but it's a good question. It's a good question.
Thank you. I try to ask them. And so, well, okay, about the hypersexualizing men. Now, isn't that a gay thing? You know, you look at a guy's magazine, a men's magazine, or, you know, just anything on the internet is like a site for guys, and they're naked women. And you look at a women's magazine, and there are pictures of $3,000 shoes. Because we don't really, you know, as you found in the strip club research that you did where women went to strip clubs for bachelorette parties, it's about bonding. It's not about, oh, my God, I'm going to just faint seeing that guy's pecs. And so, I mean, getting back to my question, is hypersexualizing men, is that like there's a gay art director, or is that about something that women really like and are comfortable with? Because they don't seem to be.
No, I don't. I agree with you. I don't think that women. I don't think that women hypersexualize men. I think that men's sexuality is just assumed, and that there's no need to make it hypersexual because it's always kind of the same level of sexual. It's just assumed that men are sexual, so you don't need to exaggerate it. Yeah.
That's very interesting. And it's something that also about women's sexuality, you talk about the relationship imperative, how women are expected to confine sexual behaviors to monogamous relationships and view sex as a vehicle to commitment, which got all mucked up by how many people got divorced and became single again.
Right. Yeah. So that it's the idea that girls, by girls, I mean teenage girls and young women, and that they learn that there is stigma for having sex outside of a relationship, that there's negative consequences for it in many cases, and so that they see that they learn that it's imperative, that it's necessary to have a relationship if they want to have sex without being judged or without being stigmatized in some way. And so, yeah, it becomes this idea of, like, if you're going to have casual sex, if you're going to hook up, then hopefully it's going to lead to a relationship, or at least you should pretend like that's your goal. Otherwise, people might think that there's something wrong with you because you you just like sex, so that's seen as a problem.
That describes my 20s. You know, I told myself I wanted a relationship, and I was so not ready for one. I didn't want one. I just wanted to fool around. And, but that really was such an unacceptable thought, and I'm not that old or anything, but that I pretended that I wanted a relationship even to myself. And then, you know, once you get a little older and a little more comfortable with yourself and you accept that you have views that are not the necessarily, quote unquote, accepted views, then you could say, you know, at a certain point, maybe it was 30 or 28 or 29, I thought, like, that's not what I want. And then, you know, as I said, when women get ready to have a relationship, they do. Then you start looking for that. You start seeking out a different kind of partner, somebody who's actually somebody who is partner material and not just somebody who'd be, you know, oh, I could, you know, be with them for 2 weeks or whatever it is.
Sure, sure, yeah. Yeah, I think that that's certainly was reflected in the comments of the women that I interviewed, that they felt, you know, sex meant something different as they got older because they realized it was not just about the physical experience, that there was more there and on both sides, more there as far as them, it wasn't just about them feeling physically desirable, but also about them feeling wanted or validated for who they were as a person, that somebody was choosing to be with them and they were choosing to be with somebody, not just for the physical aspects of the relationship.
I want to talk a little bit about sex life for older women, but first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Beth Montemurro, and her book we're discussing is Deserving Desire, Women's Stories of Sexual Evolution. So, okay, sex life for older women, how has that changed among both married and single older women? And by older, I don't mean like 90, I mean like 35
right.
or 40.
Right. So for the older women, once they got past motherhood and those that had children, once they got past the adjustment of being a mother, that sex was generally better when they were older, that it might have been less frequent, but it was better because they felt like they were doing it for the right reasons, because they really wanted to, and for the partnered women that they were usually in many of them were in longer-term relationships, and so that it was an expression of that relationship. It was a way of acknowledging the relationship, celebrating the relationship, and that was really important to them. For the women who were not partnered, who were older, that it's kind of a mixed story there, that some of them were more comfortable with being sexual on their own, with masturbating or just kind of acknowledging their sexual desire and feeling good about it and seeking out sexual partners, even if they didn't want a serious relationship. And others of them kind of said that they were done, that they felt like if they were some of the women who were in their 50s or 60s who either had been married and gotten divorced or gotten divorced more than once, kind of felt like that this was it, that was the end of their sexual days. And several of them said that was just fine with them. They felt like they had many other things in their life that brought them pleasure and that made them feel connected to the world, and so that sex was not that important to them. But go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. But overall, I think that more of the women, both partnered and unpartnered, more of the older women that I interviewed talked about how sex just became better as they got older because they were doing it because they wanted to do it, when they wanted to do it, with partners that they chose, and that they no longer felt like they had to do it to please somebody else, that it was about them. Just one important point about that is that a lot of the reason why that happened is because they realized their value beyond sex, their accomplishments in work, their accomplishments in family, their accomplishments in relationships or friendships, where they felt good about themselves and realized that this was just one aspect, their physicality, their appearance, their desirability was just one aspect of their value in the world, and that made them feel more confident in all areas of their life.
Wow, that's a very interesting and very positive revelation, I think. I like hearing that. But I do want to ask you about a cliche, the pool boy cliche. I mean, how true is that for older women who break up? Are they all chasing the pool boy, the cabana boy?
Maybe not on the East Coast, but we didn't have that. I certainly didn't have anybody like that. But there were a couple women, older women, who did talk about, you know, seeking out flings and liking the idea of it. I wrote a paper where about cougars, the idea of cougars, and how women felt about the idea of cougars. And although more women I interviewed didn't like the idea of, a lot of them liked the idea of the behavior of it, because it was like these older women who were taking charge of their sexuality, and, you know, good for them. So as far as the actual behavior, no, not so much of the women I interviewed, but I'm sure there's plenty of women out there.
Now, why do women hate the term cougar?
They felt like it was degrading, that the idea of a cougar, I mean, a cougar is a predatory animal, and so they didn't like the idea of women being on the prowl, trying to, like, get these innocent young men who were taking advantage of innocent young men. And so women didn't like that idea. They didn't like that it was a predatory kind of negative word. Other women didn't like it because they felt like it was mocking older women, because it's like a caricature rather than accepting a reality that older women can be interested in younger men, because it's just mocking this idea. It's just this exaggerated stereotype of this older woman who is, you know, too sexual, and it's embarrassing, and it's inappropriate.
See, I think this goes back to what I was saying before. You know, notice how men as predators, this is expected, it's okay. Women are the choosier sex. And so when women don't act like the choosier sex, when women start turning around and chasing the boys, we get really uncomfortable. That doesn't work for us. It's not what we evolved to expect. And I think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
And now I want to talk about faking orgasms. Now, there are some women who fake orgasms throughout the relationship. So they start the relationship and they fake the orgasm the first time, and they realize, oh my God, I can't now tell him that didn't work, that thing that I screamed about. So how does that change? After women break up, are they more honest with the next partner they sleep with, or do they do that again and get themselves in the same bind?
So for the women that I interviewed who were married and then maybe divorced in their, like, after a short period of time, particularly the older women who married with little sexual experience and married men with little sexual experience, they definitely were very interested in seeking out new experiences and thinking about communicating what they wanted and looking for a partner who was going to satisfy them, so that they were not the type of women who were going to fake it, because they didn't want to be missing out on something. And so, I think that the more women have bad experiences, the more it motivates them to want to have good experiences.
Now, interestingly, the researchers Lisa Wade and John Delometer believe that age is less significant than marital status in predicting sexual activity. I found that very interesting. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that the older you are, you know, the less frequently you're going to have sex. And that's true of people who are married, people who are divorced, and, you know, that it's just that bodies change. Your level of desire can change as you get older. And most of the women who I interviewed were comfortable with that decrease in sexual activity. They didn't expect to be having sex as frequently in their 50s and 60s as they did in their 20s. So that it's not about being in a relationship necessarily, but about what happens physiologically and what happens socially to the body as we get older.
Now, maybe I misunderstood. I thought that they thought age is less significant, that marital status is more significant, and that older, I think you wrote that older divorced and newly remarried individuals are more sexually active than those, you know, in long-term marriages. I mean, that sort of seems obvious, because people get sort of bored. It's like, oh, my God, I've had the same meal for 35 years. You know, I'm really tired. I think I'm going to quit eating. I guess, I mean, the thing that I found throughout your book that was interesting is that You know, there's in about every chapter, there's some stereotype buster or maybe a few, you know, and then there are also some things that I found that were not surprising, you know, about like sex and motherhood. You write that in the clash between the roles of mother, wife, and sexual person, mother won out time and time again. And I see that in the mail I get from guys complaining, you know, the wife had a baby. I always sort of think that's funny when people say the man did, since the woman did all the really horrible work. He just had sex with her once, lost some sperm. But that, you know, oh my God, now she's like all like baby focused. I'm nobody. And we haven't had sex for like X number of months. So, but you think maybe that does, I mean, is it, what happens there, and are there, solutions and things people need to watch out for?
I think that it's, as you said, it's expected. It's kind of inevitable. You know, you have to physically be focused on another being. There's another party entering the relationship, and that's going to change the relationship. And particularly if women are breastfeeding, and even if they're not, just the physical demands on their bodies are very different after they become mothers. And so, yeah, as far as I guess what there is to learn about it is that it's just a transition, and that most of the women I interviewed were back on track relatively shortly after, and that it was, you know, it was just something that they had to go through, and then everybody was fine.
Something interesting you wrote about was that you said a number of these women, they'd become mothers and they didn't view the lack of sex or the decrease in frequency as an indication of some personal or relationship trouble, that, like you're saying, it was just a temporary condition that was rational, and that they wanted to go back and be sexually expressive as soon as they, you know, got done with, I guess, the feeling of cracked nipples or something. I'm sorry, I'm not a mother, but
yeah.
I hear about that all the time from people. They sort of get upset about that when they become moms.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that, right, that there were several women who talked about, you know, just who wanted to have sex as soon as they could, and that they were, you know, but they just accepted the fact that their bodies had changed and were changing. And for some women, it was actually positive, because that they were turned on by different things, that they felt more comfortable with their bodies because of just the experience of motherhood, of having been naked in front of so many people during the course of their pregnancy and giving birth, that they just felt like, you know, it's really not that big of a deal, that nudity isn't that big of a deal, and their bodies aren't that big of a deal, and their bodies are powerful and could do some pretty cool things.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. I don't let people photograph me if I'm not wearing lipstick, let alone if I've got my legs spread and they can see my cervix. That really does sort of take some of the onus away of, you know, of those I've got to be perfect in photographs thing. You talk about women wanting to be sexually expressive, single women, you know, women, recently divorced women, but not wanting to set a bad example for their children. And so this is sort of an interesting conflict that goes on. How do they manage that?
Well, more of them hid it from their children and kind of just compartmentalized their sex life and their parent life, their family life. And so that one woman, you know, said she would tell her children that she had meetings. She just was going to meetings in the evening, and she was really going out on dates and really enjoying her newfound sexual freedom. But she just wasn't comfortable with her kids knowing about her dating and her having moved on. So, most of those women just kind of compartmentalized it because they felt like they didn't want to have their children see them in a different way, which points to this just desexualization of motherhood. And these were adult children, were teenage and children in their 20s, you know, so.
Well,
I,
you know,
think that
the
they would
hand,
know.
I mean, I don't think, and maybe mothers, they don't want to be slut shamed by their 14-year-old. And, you know, and,
sure.
And if you do expose all that, I mean, I see the point about the Dutch, but also, you know, that it's like, you know, if you see, if your office mate, you know, is going through a guy a week, that's one thing. If your mother is, that might be a little upsetting. That's a little different than being open about, oh, sex is normal, and, you know, that I do see the issues with that.
I get that. I think that it was in cases where it was a long-term relationship and that they just weren't really, they just wanted to keep it separate. And, you know, in some ways I think that that disadvantages them because it's like they're hiding a part of who they are. And not that they should be sexually open with what they're doing or talking about what they're doing physically, but just to not be acknowledging that part of their life, I think can be detrimental.
Yeah, that is a very good point. This is Amy Elkon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Beth Montemurro, and her book we're discussing is Deserving Desire, Women's Story of the Sexual Evolution. We are almost entirely out of time, but I wanted to just see if you had any predictions about how women's sexual evolution will continue, what will happen, what's next?
I hope that that we become more accepting. I hope that what is next is that there is some acknowledgement of desire on the part of girls and teenage girls and adolescent girls, and that, you know, I hope that that's what's next, that we become more progressive, we become more open about it, and that it's actually addressed in schools, and that families will talk about it in an age-appropriate way, so that people can become more confident.
Let's take the clitoris out of the darkness, basically.
Exactly. Well,
thank you so much, Dr. Beth Montemurro. This has been such a great show, fascinating stuff. Her book is Deserving Desire, Women's Stories of Sexual Evolution.
Thank you.
Do you promise to love each other for richer and poorer?
I do.
I now pronounce... Wait. If you'd like things to be more richer than poorer, you should open an account at Westcom. It's a member-owned, not-for-profit financial co-op that gives you low rates on loans and credit cards and great savings yields. You hear what I'm saying?
I do.
I do, too.
Westcom. The best bank for you may not be a bank at all. Westcom.org. Federally insured by NCUA. Certain terms may apply.
Landscapers, we've got your back at the Home Depot. Razorback, durable pro-grade landscaping tools for the toughest projects. And just to make your job easier, buy five or more Razorback tools now and you'll save 20%. Your crew will have the best tools in the industry, and you, you'll have savings you can take to the bank. With bulk pricing on Razorback tools, buy five or more, save 20%, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing, while supplies last.